This programming is sponsored by Linscombe Wealth, a wealth management firm partnering with individuals and families dedicated to helping them build, preserve, and manage wealth by creating a customized plan to work toward achieving their goals. More at linscombewealth.com.
This programming is sponsored by the Near Northwest Management District, located just off 290 and the 610 Loop, with a mixture of modern and mid-century homes providing families room to grow. More information at nnmd.org.
Welcome to Party Politics. I'm Jay Iyer, a political science professor from Texas Southern University.
And I'm Brandon Ruttinghouse, a political science professor from the University of Houston. Thanks for hanging out with us and talking a little bit of politics. Jay, we had a big week this week, right?
Nothing happened, Brandon. You know, we've been waiting basically the entirety of the first term of the president for this Robert Mueller report. We finally got it, allegedly got it, because no one's actually seen it. We basically got the Cliff's Notes,
right?
Allegedly Cliff Notes.
Give me the executive summary, right? Well, we're going to talk all about that, but let's run down some other things that happened that didn't involve Robert Mueller. The first is just to kind of round up on the 2020 presidential race. Jay, I'm calling this the "You Were at My Wedding, Denise" primary, because everybody's apologizing for everything. Joe Biden says he regrets how he handled Anita Hill's hearing. Kristen Gillibrand, who formerly cited and was endorsed by the NRA, has said she made a mistake. Is this going to come back to haunt these candidates in a world where the party's moving in a much more leftward direction?
I think in a word, yes. I mean, you've got all sorts of candidates out here that are essentially running away from the records, right?
Yeah.
You mentioned Kirsten Gillibrand. I mean, you're talking about someone who is an A rating from the NRA at one time. You know, she was against many of the things that she's now for.
Yeah.
One of the more moderate Democrats, actually, as a House member. And depending on the rating you look at, she's been called the most liberal member of the U.S. Senate,
yeah,
which is a huge shift in a way that you just don't normally see anymore. And obviously, Joe Biden, when the guy's basically been a senator the entirety of his life.
Since dinosaurs roam the earth, right?
Yeah, he was elected like at 29 or something like that. And so it was one of these incredible things. So he's got all sorts of issues here. But I do think it's going to matter, because I think the party is, as a whole, I'm holding people a much higher standard in sort of the liberal purity test these days.
I think it's going to be a hurdle for them. I mean, given how many options there are, I think that they can't run away from this because they've essentially copped to it. So this is going to be part of what people talk about. But Gillibrand is also in the news because she's the first to release her taxes, right? So she earned about $200,000 from a congressional salary and from book deal. She reports how much of the taxes she paid. She kind of sets a standard here. Is that going to be something others follow?
Yeah, look, I think all of them are going to end up releasing it again for that contrast with President Trump. I don't think it's... Sanders has never done it, which really raises the red flag.
Yeah.
He keeps saying he's going to. He did it in 2016 throughout the entirety of the campaign. He still hasn't done it yet, even though he claims to. If he doesn't do it, it's going to become a huge issue. It's almost as if he's hiding something. But I think the issue with Kirsten Gillibrand is, look, she is a tier three candidate right now. So she's struggling to get any kind of airtime, any kind of notice. You know, she's increasingly becoming more irrelevant. So she's trying to do something to kind of gin herself up. Joe Biden has his issues, but he's still the front runner. Quinnipiac just did another poll that came out. Kind of the race is sort of solidified to what we thought it was. The initial name ID, Biden, Sanders, you know, O'Rourke, Harris.
Right. So the Democrats want somebody who's not running and who's not a Democrat. Right.
Right.
The top two choices.
Yeah, that's literally what you have. And, you know, 187 years old.
Yeah, exactly. Let's talk quickly about Elizabeth Warren. She is just a policy machine. I mean, every 2 days she comes up with just a bevy of new targets. She's got some here targeting Iowa and rural America, which is actually pretty smart if it can play out that way. She essentially has farm supports, extra regulations to scrutinize mergers in the ag industry. There's a lot of things here, I think, that would really appeal to these kind of Democrats in states where the party didn't run as well as they could have in 2016.
Yeah, it's amazing. I don't think there's ever been a president that's run with the kind of sort of policy chops in terms of details. She's got legislation-ready policies. It's not like, you know, people have talked about other candidates kind of putting out ideas. They're very, very generic for most candidates. Hers are like laser focused, specific. And it's really interesting. I don't know how much benefit she really gets from it.
That's my question. Yeah, I mean, a wonky president isn't something people typically go for, a la President Al Gore, right? They want somebody who's kind of inspirational, somebody who kind of touches them emotionally. Warren can do that, but she's more kind of a policy wonk than she is an inspirational candidate. I know that that's going
to
help her.
I mean, I think the interesting thing to me is it's almost like she's trying to set up this contrast of sort of being the anti-Donald Trump. Donald Trump is the president who famously doesn't read, doesn't like detail, doesn't really know a lot about policy in any substantive way.
What does he do in executive time?
Right. Nothing but executive
time,
right?
Read.
Meanwhile, she's sort of set herself up as this really hardworking, detail-oriented politician, sort of with not just a bevy of ideas and policies, but kind of actual things. She has more policy ideas than I think I have friends. It's kind of ridiculous.
She's very busy. So we'll see if that plays out. I mean, that can attract a certain kind of voter, but beyond that, I am not sure. Well, let's talk about the kind of world of speculation, because the Supreme Court is chock full of it these days. Here we've got the court hearing a question about partisan gerrymandering, Jay. It's finally at the Supreme Court. We've talked a lot about this. What's going to happen, and what do you think is the outcome?
Yeah, this is the second crack at partisan gerrymandering. We talked about this before, and in the Wisconsin case, they had wanted to, we thought there might be a final standard that was set on extreme partisan gerrymandering.
This was last year, June.
Yeah,
right?
Last year, and they basically punted on it. This is another round of litigation, this time with Justice Brett Kavanaugh. And interestingly enough, the person who many thought was going to be the most partisan member of the Supreme Court is the one really questioning it more mm-hmm. than anyone else. He's asked a tremendous number of questions, calling into sort of the question as to whether or not this is a valid form of gerrymandering or drawing of lines. So a lot of balls are up in the air mm-hmm. as far as what it gets. And remember, it's only going to take one vote to kind of swing it, because right now you've got four that I think clearly are saying there needs to be a standard set on extreme partisan gerrymandering, but they're still in search of that fifth vote.
Yeah, and this, it cuts both ways, right? Because North Carolina has drawn it in lines in a more conservative way, but Maryland, the other case, has drawn it in more liberal ways, right? So the difference is really just about party, and the effect is the same. The court has been reluctant to take a definitive position on this. I mean, we saw this with the Wisconsin case. Texas is actually a good example, too. It was a racial gerrymandering issue, but they didn't go that far in terms of remedying things from a racial perspective. So I'm not sure we're going to see any kind of major change here. But of course, we've been wrong about what the court does before.
Exactly. Well, Brandon, the 2020 election, in many ways, we've talked about all the big issues they're going to be talking about, immigration obviously being one. But the Green New Deal has emerged as this major flashpoint. It made it through the House, and sua sponte, as the courts would say, Mitch McConnell decides to put it all directly on the floor of the U.S. Senate.
Really smart.
And it went down in a massive defeat.
It was smart of him to do that, right? I mean, he definitely shows definitively that this is not something that anybody wants to do, including the party that is promoting this. It went down so quickly, but it went down in a house-made, artisan, organic kind of way that I think we can all appreciate, right? I think that this pushed the party too far too fast in a liberal direction. It's clear that this is a policy frame that will appeal to some Democrats and maybe where the party will go, but this vote was a representation of where the party is currently.
Yeah, I mean, I think sort of the two big flashpoints, obviously, were one, Mike Lee, the senator from Utah, got up there and gave this sort of mocking presentation and speech, sort of railing against the Green New Deal, and it got a pretty humorous and aggressive slapback from Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who was the author of it in the House.
Yeah, so speaking of slapback, Jay, here we've got Obamacare under attack again. So the Department of Justice is siding with a district court ruling that found the ACA unconstitutional. Basically, what the Justice Department wants to do is to suggest that ACA should be thrown out in its entirety. And the problem is, of course, if that happens, then kind of undoing the nation's healthcare policy as it is. What do you think is going to happen here? I mean, what is the strategy politically for DOJ in doing this? And what do you think is going to happen?
Yeah. So, this is a week where the president got what he would call fantastic news from Robert Mueller. And he literally decided to instead of just taking a victory lap, he decided to once again wade into something that is a huge loser for him. Essentially voiding Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, would have the effect of denying health coverage for tens of millions of Americans going to an election year. His Republican senators and House members are running away from this like crazy. The president doubled down on something that is incredibly unpopular for regardless of your views on Obamacare. If you don't have a viable replacement, it is a huge loser to argue it needs to go away. big, big foul for Trump. It's just, this is the, as they say in soccer, an own goal. This is a terrible thing to do. It's just dumb. It's a stupid thing to do.
I totally agree. I thought about it differently. This is why you put a cone around a dog's head after they have surgery, like so that they won't mess with the wound, right?
Oh, that's a great analogy. It's a great visualization of what just happened.
Yeah, exactly, right? Like the president was given really a gift. I mean, we'll see how it plays out. We'll talk about that. But they cannot stop picking at this wound. And this is a terrible thing for Republicans. The timing is terrible for Trump. And so I don't know what they're doing. The polling on this is so clear, right? 60+% of the American people say that the American Affordable Care Act should protect pre-existing conditions. That's why they like it. They also like it that it doesn't allow for insurance companies to charge more for people who are sick. These are the kind of things that really can stem a political momentum. And this seems to be what the administration's good at, and I think it was a completely unforced error, and it's going to come back to hurt them. Now, Trump said this is going to be the case, that the Republican Party will now be known as the party of healthcare, but we don't know what that looks like, right? It's just they're the party of taking down this healthcare system, maybe, but what will be replacing it?
Yeah, it's so much harder to build something than to tear it down, right. And this is one of those where if you don't have a viable replacement, you look like a fool.
Yeah.
And so I think from the president's perspective, this is just, I mean, it's literally like sort of self-immolation, yeah. Right? He dumped a gallon of gasoline on himself and lit a match at a time when he could be touting, yeah. You know, vindication, which is what he likes.
Yeah, in a week where they were talking about prescription drug prices, right. The Speaker of the House and the president's staff had sort of moved on that. That was something that could be solved. That seems to be out the window now. But I think Republicans can take a deep breath because it's unlikely that this in terms of the legal system is going to go anywhere, right? The arguments don't play out in such a way because the argument is basically like Congress removed the financial penalty for not having the insurance, which was required. So they argue basically then the whole thing topples. It's probably not going to go that far, but that's the logic. So I just can't imagine that they're that worried about it, but it's just bad publicity for the Republicans and the president.
Well, Brandon, we've talked all about presidents in the past here, and I think it's a good time to acknowledge the fact that arguably our greatest former president, who has the most interesting and most, I think, public-minded career as an ex-politician in recent memory, has been Jimmy Carter. He is now our oldest living president.
Wow. In a way, it's a good measure of the health of democracy, right? Our former leaders stick around and they do good things, right? They raise money, they observe elections in their countries. This is, I think, a good thing for America, a good thing for democracy.
And fun fact, Jimmy Carter and my son have the same birthday, which is why my son's middle name is, in fact, Carter.
That is so interesting. Oh, yeah. Very cool.
All right, well, let's shift gears to Texas. We got a lot going on. Brandon, the big budget battle has begun. It's not much of a battle this year.
No.
Yeah, the Texas budget is being debated as we speak. Lots of goodies in there for a lot of people. Lots of amendments are going to be flying. What's your take on it?
You know, there was a surprising outcome. It didn't take as long as it has in the past, only something like 12 hours. I literally watched probably about 10 hours of this. I am that nerd, but you can see a lot of interesting things. They eventually passed a budget, a pretty big budget, a $251 billion budget. That's general revenue from the state as well as the financial input from the federal government. The House also signed off on a $9 billion supplemental budget that's going to use a bunch of money, about $4 billion from the state rainy day fund. There was bipartisan unity, Jay. The budget passed unanimously. Let me say that again. The budget passed unanimously. There were no fist fights as there were last year. There were only a modest number of eye rolls. So I don't know where the Texas legislature that we love is, but this is not it. Bonin had a big test here, and I think John Zerwas, who's the head of the Appropriations Committee, who shepherded this time as well as last biennium, did a really good job. They passed the test. If the question was, can they govern in a bipartisan, unifying way, the answer is totally yes.
Yeah, Speaker Bonin should definitely take a bow on this. I mean, I think there were some questions going in as to how he would sort of be able to wrangle this. But I mean, we saw two things. One, the right flank on the House side is essentially nullified,
right.
Mollified, however you want to describe it, and is just no longer a factor. And Democrats, to their credit, were not standing on this notion of one, much like you see in Washington, standing on this idea that we're going to go further left. This is a centrist budget, for lack of a better word, a center-right budget. It adds a lot. It adds a lot of positive things. Everyone could agree upon it. It was an open, transparent process, and now it goes over to the Senate and to a lot of conversation there.
And the reason I think that happened is that a lot of the members were willing to kind of push off their budget requests to what they call Article 11. Basically, this is like Narnia. It's a wish list, and they'll debate that later. So a lot of people, sort of for the good of the movement and to try to get things done, push their wish list back, and so they'll debate that later. But that suggests that they have a lot of trust in Dennis Bonin to sort of properly and fairly adjudicate that down the road. You know, Democrats lost a few things. I mean, there was a discussion about expanding Medicaid, which didn't go anywhere. There's also sort of funding for the 2020 census outreach, which had to get pushed into Article 11, so that may be funded, but probably not. So there's some things they lost on, but some things they won on. There was some discussion about needing to have a kind of state plan to transition for the future of healthcare when the waiver that the state has runs out. So there are, I think, some, you know, good and bad points here, but that's how budgets are, right? It's too many people to make everybody happy.
Well, speaking of, not making everyone happy, we know there was a Texas abortion bill. We talked a lot about this session being one in which there's much more sort of collegiality going on,
yeah,
a lot less of the sort of traditional sort of social issues that are dividing. The one issue that's still out there is a new round of an abortion bill. It's really rankled some Democrats. What's going on with that?
Yeah, so this week there was a hearing on a legislation filed by Jeff Leach, who's a Republican from Plano. The legislation's thrust basically suggests that a doctor can be fined if they fail to provide appropriate medical treatment for a fetus that lives through an attempted abortion. Democrats skipped the hearing altogether. That wouldn't otherwise be news, except that the 9-member panel didn't have a quorum because one of the members, who's a Republican, was late. They had a delayed flight. So this is why I teach the importance of a quorum, right? It tends to be something that we don't think about much, but if you don't have sufficient number of legislators there, they cannot proceed. It also suggests to me that this is a really powerful non-legislative show of strength for Democrats. That's something that we don't see this early, and we rarely see it at all until sort of later on. So I think that's something which is pretty interesting. I do think Dennis Bonin's going to get some blowback on this. I mean, that committee is pretty well balanced, Republicans and Democrats, and we saw what happens when that obviously goes the way of the Democrats. So Bonin may rethink this, but I think that this is clearly, as you say, the kind of fight that's going to continue.
Yeah, and this is one of those fights where on a tiny sliver of the abortion debate in order to sort of make a larger political point. And so it's one of those things I think that Republicans really look to as a means to kind of put Democrats in this box. And it's one of those reasons that I think the Speaker, as you said, is going to get some blowback, particularly from sort of right to life groups. Let's shift gears a little bit, because we talked about this last week and I just kind of wanted to give an update. But there was, as you know, in Deer Park, there was a massive explosion which resulted in a toxic plume of smoke. There was a benzene alert, and it basically shut down a good percentage of the ship channel. Billions of dollars of income went. Lots of problems. There were a lot of criticism on some of the elected officials, but a lot of the criticism, justifiably so, was garnered at ITC, the corporation that owns it and runs that facility. Now, we had said this last week, the county and the AG need to get involved in this and file lawsuits. And lo and behold, Ken Paxton saying he is going to pursue litigation. And Harris County just issued a right to sue to the county attorney to pursue legal action against ITC. This is a huge amount of money. I believe ITC's parent company is Toyota.
Wow, there you go. Deep pockets, right? You called this last week. You said they need to be involved, and here they are. I think it's a good thing, right? This literally is shutting down a tremendous amount of industry, which cannot continue. So I think this is probably a wise thing, but we're not going to see the end of this litigation for years, right, Jay, given how complex and interconnected all these things are?
We've talked about this before, but the biggest issue in the state of Texas is the failure of state agencies to do basic regulations. We've seen failure after failure, and nobody ever holds the governor accountable. TECQ, which is the Environmental Quality Control Agency, basically the equivalent of the EPA in Texas, was completely asleep on this. And it's been a huge problem, and nobody holds the governor accountable. I'm not even aware the governor made a statement about this.
Yeah. Hey, from one explosion, Jay, to another, this week here in Houston, the Texas Education Agency suspended the district's superintendent search. Jay, are we just basically a half a step from the takeover of HISD by the state? Is this the best way to fix struggling schools? What's your take?
Yeah, I don't know if we're a half a step away, but I mean, it was pretty dramatic. I mean, the HISD board was set to name a finalist kind of Tuesday, Wednesday of this past week, and they turn around and at the 11th hour get this issue, this letter, this sort of almost this cease and desist order by Mike Morath, basically saying, nope, you can't do it. We're going to suspend it because of that the conservatory is going to now sort of be overseeing the board on a more updated basis.
Do they have a different idea about how to proceed, or is just that they're kind of flexing their muscle and saying, we're in charge and you're not?
Well, I think at this stage, they're in charge. The TEA is in charge because effectively what they've said is that the conservator for the district, they had appointed a conservator previously, has to approve these kinds of decisions and frankly, other decisions. School boards in general only really have to do two things. They've got to pass budgets and they've got to hire and fire superintendents. 50% of what HISD's board is supposed to do, they can no longer do independently.
Right. The one thing they're really good at, though, is screaming at each other during meetings. So maybe that should be added to your list of things that they do, right?
Yeah. Right now, that's pretty much about 75% of what they've been able to do.
It's a little too much. Well, we talked a second ago about the agencies in Texas. There's a pretty blockbuster report from my buddy Justin Miller from the Texas Observer, who has some pretty surprising news that lobbyists for this app called Handy essentially had been working with the Texas Workforce Commission to set certain marketplace contractor rules. Essentially, it's suggesting that people who are these sort of at-will type employees aren't necessarily real full employees so that the companies don't have to pay the state unemployment insurance. Jay, what's the impact of this? Because there's so much of what we sort of do now is the kind of gig economy, right? It's such a growing part of the country, but also Texas.
Yeah, it's a huge issue, right? So the question is that if you're an independent contractor, whether you drive for Uber or Lyft, or you're in one of these sort of parts of the sharing or gig economy, the new economy of Texas, if you get no longer working there, should you be eligible for unemployment insurance? Well, this ruling by the TWC is basically saying no. Or at least this regulation. And this is not the legislature or the governor doing this.
Right.
There's a regulatory authority. And these rules will have huge impacts on potentially millions of Texans.
Yeah, totally. And this demonstrates the critical importance of these agencies, like you just said, on a different subject. And also, I think, highlights that it's important who gets to do the choosing. That's the governor, right? So we can't forget that so many of the rules and so much policy is made at this level. So people need to pay attention. And I'm glad that the media is doing that, because this is a pretty major rule. Now, it may be something they're okay with, but this definitely has to be sort of thought through.
Well, one of the biggest hearings in the Texas legislature just took place. We've had the hearing on whether or not the official breakfast food of the state of Texas is, in fact, the breakfast taco. Brandon, where do you weigh in on this tense debate?
This is the pressing issue of our day, Jay. Forget about public education. Forget about border security. Will Texas specify the breakfast taco as its breakfast food? I think the answer is going to be yes. No one testified in opposition to the bill, which was introduced by Representative Click. The proposal has been vetted through the House Culture, Recreation, and Tourism Committee. So we will see. But there was some pushback from Jarvis Johnson, who I think is one of your students from here in Houston, asking questions like, we should be specific about what kind of taco, right? Because you've got bacon, you've got potatoes, you've got just straight egg. Lots of variation here, Jay. But let me ask you this. What's your favorite place to get breakfast tacos?
God, that's a great question. There's a bunch of places I like here. There's places in the Heights that I think are great in Houston. I don't want to name drop. And frankly, they're not sponsors of the show.
If they sponsored it, we'd totally
name
drop.
Yes, in fact, and that's word out there. If you want to be a sponsor of the show, we will name drop your breakfast taco.
I'm not going to tell you my favorite place. I'll tell you my second favorite place, and that is that Merida over here on Navigation. Such a great breakfast taco. Nice and big. It will fill you up for the whole day, and you'll need a nap, which is exactly the point of breakfast tacos, right?
Well, Brandon, let's shift a little gears, talk about the big story of the week, the report we've all been waiting for.
It's not here still.
It's not here still, exactly, right? So what we're talking about is Special Counsel Robert Mueller has finally delivered the report on Russian interference in the 2016 election to Attorney General Bill Barr. Bill Barr then gave us what might be kindly described as Cliff Notes versions, a 700-page document reduced to 4 pages, including, of course, the introduction and the conclusion. So not much told. We know 3 things. We know that, in fact, the Russians did interfere in the 2016 election. That is now a stated as a fact. We also know that the president of the United States is not going to be implicated in collusion in any way between his campaign or him directly and the Russian government. And we also know that the president's not exonerated, right, which is specifically stated in there. Now, the one thing to remember is that they basically punted on the question whether there was a obstruction of justice claim. The argument
the report did,
yes,
as summarized by the attorney general.
Exactly. Right? And here's sort of the interesting legal distinction. The argument that the attorney general is making, because he is making an argument, which is he's basically saying, look, if there was no collusion, then the underlying cover-up, not to use the word cover-up, but the obstruction related to the collusion cannot occur.
Right.
It's kind of a little bit like in law, the theory behind conspiracy. If you don't have the underlying crime, you can't conspire to that crime. Mm-hmm. This is a very new definition of what collusion would be. So or obstruction of justice would be, rather.
Yeah.
So I think it's an interesting thing, and it has created a storm of controversy.
That's right. And part of the storm is about the kind of whether or not this report should be public, right? And now we don't, as we said, have it. The attorney general says basically they're protecting grand jury proceedings, and so they won't release it. I'm guessing we're going to see parts of the report maybe redacted, but this, of course, isn't the end of it. Even if it was the case that we had some of it, we're still going to have hearings, and the Congress is still going to investigate more and more. So I don't think we're talking about too much that's going to be different. But to me, what's also not different is that it doesn't really change the political calculation of the president, right? Things are still divided. People who believe that he colluded are going to believe it. People who don't aren't. Trump's numbers, I think, among Republicans could be improved. I mean, as it is now, leaning Republicans only approve of his job performance by about 50 to 60%. So that's likely to jump up to more kind of where it was for strong Republicans at about 80%. But nearly half of people in a poll that came out on the Fourth Morning Consult suggested that people still think that President Trump obstructed the Russia probe, right? Literally half of people still believe this to be true. So politically speaking, I'm not sure we're going to see much movement here except just a kind of steady dripping of questions about this.
Yeah, I think you're right there. I think as far as the president goes, his ability, as he's done often in the past, to just sort of claim vindication, it is really what it's about, right? That's what you're seeing. We don't know what the report actually says. All we know is sort of a letter, but the president's not going to sleep on that. He's already out there saying he's been fully exonerated.
Right.
You can tell in just sort of his language that this is over in his mind, and he's already shifted gears to 2020, which is why I think, and we talked about this earlier, which is why some of the political moves he's made, particularly on the Affordable Care Act, was such a sort of a self-inflicted wound when he should be just basically trying to run up the score, get the base back, disaffected Republicans that maybe thought he had colluded with the Russians.
I agree. Well, this week, too, they are cutting $17 million from the Special Olympics. He said that Puerto Rico is getting too much disaster relief money. Like, they're basically putting their foot in their mouth the entire time. Republicans would like to move on. But I think for them, this gives a lot of moderates some cover, right? Because they had defended the president, I think, weakly, but now they can do it more kind of firmly. For Democrats, I think the pressure's off too, honestly. So now they can focus on hearings that are going to be more impactful. Scandals are most impactful when they are more recent and more financial in origin, as they can investigate things like the president's tax returns or internal security clearance issues, right? Or a host of things happening at the cabinet level. Democrats are not going to miss this. I mean, there are going to be a lot of things that they can talk about politically, and they can pivot to issues like the border wall, immigration, right? These are things that inflame their base as much as anything else. So that's something they can focus on. So politically, again, I'm not sure this really changed the calculation.
Yeah, I think the big winner on this is Nancy Pelosi, because she doesn't have to worry about impeachment talk as much as she did before.
Yeah.
Well, that's it for this week. Party Politics is recorded in the George B. Geary Performance Studio at Houston Public Media.
Big thanks to our producer, Sophie Mall. Special kudos to our web and graphics team here at Houston Public Media. And finally, thanks to our audio engineer, Todd. No impeachment, all slander.
I'm Jay Iyer.
And I'm Brandon Rottinghouse. We'll see you next week.
Mm-hmm. This programming is sponsored by the Near Northwest Management District, Houston's hidden gem, with a developer-friendly environment and Houston's sixth largest business center. More information at nnmd.org.